Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is State v. Peter Draper. Mr. Brewster, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm not
going to
do that.
The answer is yes.
All right. Good morning. My name is Charles Brewster. I'm with the firm of Anderson, Klein, Brewster, and Brandt, Kearney and Holdridge. Today I represent the appellant in this matter, Peter Draper. Mr. Draper was convicted of two felony counts, one of child abuse resulting in serious bodily injury, and one count of child abuse resulting in death in the District Court of Franklin County. This case has been here before. We appealed the result of the first trial, and it was reversed, and the state tried it again on the same charges, and he was convicted again by a jury on those same charges. The little boy that suffered several incidents of child abuse was 2-year-old Joseph Reinhardt Jr. Jr., as everyone called him, died on April 30th, 2012 from head trauma and a perforated colon allegedly committed at the hands of Mr. Draper. The circumstances of how these people live, Your Honor, is this. There's a little town outside of Franklin called Napanee. There's not very many people there, I think 200 or 300. And Peter Draper and his wife Nancy bought a trailer house there. They were originally from Florida way back when. Their daughter, Laura Reinhardt, had four children. Laura Reinhardt, her husband Joseph, and the four children moved to Napanee, and they all moved into this trailer house. It's pretty cramped in there, I believe. Joseph Reinhardt Sr., the father of the four children, he left, and he has nothing to do with this at all. Wasn't a witness, had no part in it. But Laura Reinhardt remained with the four children, living with Mr. Draper and his wife, Mrs. Draper. State's evidence in this matter against Mr. Draper, Your Honor, was based on essentially two things. One, Laura Reinhardt's testimony about what she saw during the course of them living there in this house, and then a mountain of medical evidence which the state was able to procure and successfully offer to the court for the jury's consideration. Of note is the fact that Mr. Draper is deaf. He suffers from multiple sclerosis, and oddly it's the MS that caused his deafness. He's stone deaf. He did not testify at this trial. Basis for our appeal is essentially on evidentiary issues. The first one is an error committed by the court regarding the admission of 404 evidence, which we believe was done erroneously. During the course of the trial, there was testimony from two witnesses, social workers, that had visited the Draper home at one point, and they had come back to visit again. When they came back to visit again, it was during daylight hours. Mr. Draper saw them pull up in front of his house, and he went out to confront them. During that confrontation, he got pretty nasty. And, you know, the ladies were there. I think they wanted to help, but he didn't want any part of them. He was tired of people coming to his house and making insinuations and allegations of child abuse. During the course of the trial, the state offered this evidence about this confrontation between him and the social workers. It's the appellant's position that this evidence had absolutely nothing to do with child abuse. All it essentially proved was that when provoked, Mr. Draper was a jerk. And if you read the transcript, or the bill of exceptions, you'll see that, you know, he was very, very nasty to them. And our position is that the admission of this testimony was improper 404 evidence, completely irrelevant to the issues before the court, and should not have been admitted.
I believe the state characterizes this as inextricably intertwined.
I saw that. And, Your Honor, I don't
Why is it not inextricably intertwined?
Okay. So the allegation is child abuse. And child abuse against Joseph Jr., 2-year-old. This incident happened outside of the house. The social workers were there. Joseph Jr. is nowhere around. And essentially, it's Peter Graper telling them, yeah, get out of here, mind your own business, I'm sick of you people coming around. And like I said, he was very, very nasty about it. I don't see how that behavior is in any way, shape, or form intertwined with any act he may have committed in the form of abusing a child. I just don't see that.
Is it part of a broader picture of the climate in this home and the,
well,
the sort of
you know, Judge, I think that's a pretty broad brush, painting a pretty broad stroke. If we had evidence of people, you know, being cranky and nasty towards other people during the course of their interactions with them, as evidence of all of our trials, geez, we have a lot more convictions, I think. I believe that the court improperly admitted this, and I believe the jury should not have heard about it. I'm not really sure why the state even offered it. It seemed like setting themselves up for a real problem here, but they did.
The court gave a limiting instruction. What's your position with respect to that limiting instruction?
You know what, Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that. This is something that has bothered me for years. We lawyers understand what a limiting instruction is. You know, we are trained in the law. We know what the evidence is. But if you've got 12 lay people sitting there and they've heard this back and forth exchange between the lawyers objecting and then the court making a ruling, and then the judge says, well, ladies and gentlemen, there's evidence of character offered here, but you're to disregard that and you can consider it for other purposes. I guarantee you that those 12 jurors are up there thinking, huh? What does that mean?
Did you request an alternative?
We actually got an no, I didn't. I had hoped that he would tell them to totally disregard it. That would have been much, much better. We did have an instruction to the jurors about it. Before they went to deliberate, the written instructions. But that instruction didn't specify what it was he was talking about. Didn't specify what character evidence it is. Now, the lawyers and the judge, we all know what the character evidence is. The jurors don't know.
Did the judge say what this evidence was good for?
He did not.
Could we consider this under a harmless error analysis?
Well,
it's so irrelevant to the case.
You know, it is, but, well, and I just saw this when I walked in here. You have this written above you. Eyes and ears are poor witnesses when the soul is barbarous. Well, what a better way to make a finder of fact, you know, be a little bit barbarous than to show that the accused is being nasty to little old ladies, you know, coming to help. And is it harmless? You know, Your Honor, I suppose you could find that. Being in the environment.
Mr. Brewster, it was a 6-day trial, was it not?
It was.
Seven?
Well, wait a minute. No, the first trial, I think, was 6 days. This one, I think we finished in less than a week. I think it was 5 days. 5 days.
We'll go with 5 days.
Okay. It was a long time.
700 and some odd pages in the Bill of Exceptions.
Yes.
And not only this incident, but you've complained in your brief of two other incidents.
Yes.
why aren't they just, what's your best argument that these are, at most, blips in the scope, in other words, the harmless error in the scope of a 5, or I think the record says it's 6 days, but we'll go with your 5 days.
It was a long week, all. My best argument, Your Honor, is this. In talking to jurors over the years after trials, it has always amazed me that often there are just little pieces of things that flip how the jurors feel about a defendant and whether or not they consider the defendant guilty or not guilty.
Isn't that an argument there's no such thing as harmless error?
We're getting there. I think that what the state was trying to do here, Judge, is to prove that Peter Graber was a jerk. And that because he was a jerk, he had to be the guy that committed the child abuse. It was either him or Nancy Graber, who didn't appear at this trial at all, or Laura Reinhart. And their evidence with Laura Reinhart showed her to be this nice little lady that couldn't possibly have done this. But I believe that's what the state was intending to do with this 404 evidence, and I think it worked.
The closing argument, I think, touches on one of these three incidents, and only in the state's argument, and only towards the very end of their argument. It certainly wasn't the thrust of their case, was it?
Well, no, I don't think so. And maybe, the assistant attorney generals who tried this case, they're smart, good lawyers, good trial lawyers, and they may have recognized that, oh boy, you know, we may have, you know, stepped too far here and ignored that. They certainly had plenty of other stuff to talk about, you know, all the medical.
Mountains of medical evidence, yeah. As you said.
Yeah. So, I see your point, Judge, but I've got some time, and I don't want to worry.
Counsel, just a quick question.
Yes, sir.
Back to the limiting instruction, you know, I think we all understand that lay people may look at the law differently than trained attorneys. So you made a valid point there. But your point is that, well, they're not going to listen to the instruction, they're just going to view the evidence anyway. But we give them numerous instructions on elements that they have to find, what beyond a reasonable doubt is, presumption of innocence. Doesn't the legal system as a whole have to rely upon jurors that they are going to follow those instructions? Otherwise, the system doesn't work, does it?
I think jurors are quite good at interpreting facts, figuring out what happened during the course of trials. I think they have fits with the legal end of it.
But we count on them to follow those instructions, don't we?
Well, we do.
And there's no other approach, at least that I've not heard of anybody saying that there's any other approach if we're going to have jury of our peers, are we? I mean, we have to have untrained lay people apply the law to the facts, don't we?
We do. And I guess my answer to your question about it, to me, a limiting instruction is like unringing a bell. You know, putting the toothpaste back in the tube after it's out. I mean, you just can't get it done. What the court should have done here is said, you know, ladies and gentlemen, you got to disregard that voice change.
So it's really the court ruling that's of a concern, not so much the instruction part.
Yes. I mean, I think...
What did you ask for?
Well, you know, I didn't ask for anything. I made the objection, and the court gave the limiting instruction, and... Did I ask for the court to instruct them to disregard? No, I didn't. Judge Ellingworth's a great judge, knows what he's doing, but you know, he's somebody, you don't second guess him in front of a jury. You just don't, and that's fine. So I took what I could get, and we went from there.
Is there a motion for mistrial?
No. No, I didn't think this rose to the point that it would be a mistrial.
Let's go back to the facts for a second. You really have, you agree that there are really only three people in this household other than the victim.
Correct.
Of significance, and nobody is making any suggestion that we'll call her Grandma is, or Nancy, is implicit in this situation. So it really boils down to Laura or your client.
He said, she said.
And what evidence, if any, was there that would suggest that Laura was a mover in this?
I think the evidence that she was primarily in charge of the children all the time, that my client was physically not particularly able to move out and do the kind of things that are alleged. He spent a lot of time either sleeping or, you know, not in the house. And during the cross-examination of Laura, I believe that we were able to elicit testimony from her that would indicate that she certainly had the propensity to do this. She was a trained combat soldier and certainly was under stressful circumstances. So my instructions from my client were to leave Grandma alone, that she had nothing to do with this, and that's what we did.
Thank you.
Was there any evidence of abuse of the other children?
The brother of the deceased had some sort of odd bone calcification problem, and they were continuously going to doctors about this. My client and I think Laura and Grandma thought that Junior had this problem also. There was never any allegation or any evidence of any abuse towards any of the other children, although...
What was the cause of death? The
cause of death was head trauma and a perforated colon.
And how were they caused? What was the problem?
Well,
the method of causing the head trauma?
The evidence that was offered through Ms. Reinhart was that the head trauma and perforated colon came from Mr. Draper taking Junior to a back bedroom. She didn't see this part of it. There was some testimony, I believe, that she heard a big thump, which we could conclude was Junior's head bouncing off a headboard of a bed. And then she saw Mr. Draper holding Junior down on the bed with his knee. And I think the state's theory was that the weight on his pelvis this way caused a perforation of the colon. And it doesn't take much of a perforation of the colon to cause a real problem. The little boy died a horrible death, Judge. I mean, that's just awful. My client's position was always that he needed to put his knee on his stomach like that. So that's how he died. That's what the medical evidence showed, and we had no reason to dispute it. I guess the other error that I wanted to visit very briefly about, I don't have much time left, had to do with kind of an unusual set of circumstances during the trial, some testimony where the social workers were at the house before the other incident we discussed. They were inside the house, And there was testimony offered by the state that social workers went to a cafe and they sat down and immediately after the visit and started crying. We objected to that in the form of this being an improper opinion by virtue of the display of this emotion. The judge allowed it, and we believe that that testimony or that expression of what happened in the cafe was extremely inflammatory. Again, an attempt to prove that the defendant and the appellant were jerks.
How did the judge respond to your objection?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to confess, I'm running out of time here, but we made a mistake. The first witness testified, and it went past me. And when I realized what had happened, I thought, okay, let it go. But then when the second witness testified to the same thing, we objected. The court's response was, you know, counsel, the other witness testified to this. The evidence is that, you know, they were crying. That's it. Move on. But it was there, and I think that that was improperly admitted. So, well, I see I'm out of time. If there are no other questions, then thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Faust, good morning to you.
Presents really five assignments there, none of which have any merit. I will start off with the 404. He challenges as inadmissible 404 Bradley and Goodell's testimony about their December 15th confrontation with Draper. The state submits that it is intrinsic. It's not 404 to the charged offenses because it was admitted, not admitted for Draper's character. It was admitted to actually show the true factual setting of the crimes. You have to take into context the scheduled visits prior to the December 15th confrontation. There was two of them with these social workers. And at those scheduled visits, the Draper house is immaculate. Laura Reinhart and Nancy Draper are offering the social cookies and cocoa. Draper makes a brief appearance, merely introduces himself, and then leaves the conversation. He's acting as if he has no involvement in the child and the well-being of these children. And during the time that Junior was severely abused, as they tended to portray at that time during the scheduled visits. And then you have the December 15th confrontation. It's an unscheduled visit. He won't let them in the house. He's yelling and screaming derogatory terms at them. And in short, he's revealing that his control that he does have in that household is, he believes he's losing it. He's losing that control. And it corroborates Laura Reinhart's testimony that he is in control in that household, and he is the disciplinarian of those children. The state believes that if this court would disagree, in any event, the district court did give a limiting instruction. Mr. Brewster's argument presumes that the jury doesn't follow instructions, and our case law is that they do. And further, that any error would be harmless in any event, because the jury's not going to rest its verdict on an unsurprising, angry reaction from Draper after his family has just been accused of child abuse.
Counsel, in your brief, you have that, just as you argued, that in any event it's harmless error, emotional reaction testimony, in any event it's harmless error. And I think there was one other, you have harmless error.
Laura's testimony.
Lay opinion or testimony. Mm-hmm. Let's say that you can have harmless error in a serious trial like this, but isn't there a point where when this court's being asked to ignore because it's harmless error, harmless error, harmless error, isn't there a cumulative effect at some point where this is a real problem, it's constant harmless error?
Absolutely, depending on the error that's assigned, but not in these cases. And not in context of Laura Reinhart's testimony and the corroborating medical evidence of it, not in conjunction with the HHS workers who testified without objection that when they're coming, they're on unscheduled visits, just like Bradley and Goodell and the other teacher, that he is controlling that household. He doesn't want Laura to answer questions without him. He doesn't want them to see inside the bedroom with all of that testimony, all of
but
that evidence.
You're arguing each individual one now. My point is, isn't there a cumulative effect that we have to worry about at some point?
And my answer is yes, in another case, not in this one.
Okay. And tell me why there's not a cumulative effect in this case.
Because of the individual errors that they are. They just don't matter in the scheme of the evidence against Draper that was properly admitted, both, you know, without objection.
Okay. So you're saying that the conviction would have been gained even without any of these?
Absolutely. The verdict was surely unattributable, any of these errors, if they were errors.
Okay. Thank you.
What we already discussed, I think the lay opinion and the emotional reaction testimony is harmless. The lay opinion testimony was actually Laura's testimony that she was asked about a bruise on Junior's ear that's seen in one of the autopsy photographs, and she didn't see it happen. She assumed it happened on the bed railing, but she never said anybody caused it. So that's just one example of it just makes no difference in this trial as a whole. And then Goodell's testimony that she and two others left and cried after the first scheduled visit. Bradley testified the same, without objection.
What was the age of the child?
2 years old.
It was a toddler then?
Yes, and he had basically been tortured by his grandfather from the age of 1 year old. The other assignment of errors have to do with sufficiency. As I said, Laura's testimony more than enough established the elements. He challenges her as unbelievable, but as this court knows, it can't reassess credibility, and her testimony was corroborated by the medical evidence. And then we have excessive sentence. He got 60 to life on the intentional child abuse resulting in death, and a consecutive 49 to 50 for the intentional child abuse resulting in serious bodily injury. They're within the statutory limits.
Is it the same sentence imposed with respect to each conviction as following the first trial?
Yes. Yes. And it was absolutely validated. He tortured his grandson for nearly a year of his life. It's not excessive. There are no further questions? We ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are out of time for rebuttal. So we will go